Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In a recent piece about Donald Trump's judicial nominees, today's guest, journalist Dahlia Lithwick, writes, "If the Republic survives 4 years of Donald Trump, much of the damage he has done to civil liberties, environmental protections, health coverage, reproductive freedom, LGBTQ rights, and police reform can theoretically be undone. What cannot be undone, regardless of what the future may hold, are his Article III federal judicial appointees. These judges will sit for life, and many of them have been selected expressly for the long, long lifespans they will bring to the bench." Well, 9 months into Donald Trump's presidency, Neil Gorsuch is a Supreme Court justice, and 57 Trump nominees sit on federal courts throughout the country. That is more than five times the number of nominations Barack Obama had made this far into his first term. So how has he been able to move so quickly on this? Our second guest, journalist David Dayan, writes, "There's a large infrastructure on the right dedicated solely to confirming judges. The Federalist Society is a college-based networking organization with tens of thousands of members, which identifies bright conservative law students and assists them in their career path, up to and including securing lifetime appointments to the courts." On today's Your Call, we are talking about an issue that deserves far more attention: Donald Trump's judicial nominees, who's behind them, what they represent, and what is at stake for the future of the courts. Today, we're joined by Dahlia Lithwick. She writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia joins us from Slate Studios in Brooklyn. Hi, Dahlia. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your reporting on this. We're also joined by David Dayan. David writes for The Nation, The Intercept, and The New Republic. He's also author of Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, which won the Ida and Studs Terkel Prize. David was on talking about that book a couple months ago, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. Actually, I was okay until Dahlia sent over this article. Dahlia, before we dive in and talk about what's happening here, you just sent over an article that was just written by Chris Massey at CNN called "Trump Judicial Nominee Said Transgender Children Are Part of Satan's Plan and Defended Conversion Therapy." This is Jeff Mateer, the current First Assistant Attorney General of Texas. Let's just start off here and talk about how extreme some of these picks are.
I think it's extraordinary. If you go back and think, Rose, that the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation at the Supreme Court level was almost derailed because she had the temerity to say that sometimes a wise Latina woman will come to a different conclusion than a wise white man. And that, right, that was apocalyptically disqualifying. And now here we have folks who are literally, you know, that this video just went up on CNN this morning. We have a Trump nominee for the Fifth Circuit for a district court judgeship saying in a video that's been posted on Vimeo things like, Satan's plan is working through, questions of sexual identity and mocking a child who was trans and talking about conversion therapy. And it's just such an extraordinary disjunction between what is deemed disqualifying when an Obama judge says something and the kind of just virulent stuff that folks are saying on the right, and they get confirmed regardless.
Why do they get confirmed regardless?
Well, I think that's the nut of the problem, and it's the reason that, you know, I think David and I have written what we've written, which is this is the most ignored problem for progressives, which is that the right in this country is laser focused on one thing and one thing only, and that is the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade, the Second Amendment, right to bear arms. The issues that eventually make their way to the court are so singularly important that for decades, decades, since the Mies Revolution in this country, we've seen Republicans organize on this in ways that, as David has written, start with recruiting in law school, build up huge networks, and then pop people into lifetime appointments on the federal courts when they're 40 years old. There's no analog on the left. The left was not organized around the courts. The left did not rise up when Merrick Garland was blockaded last year. Polls show that by almost a 2-to-1 margin, people who held their nose and voted for Trump did it over one issue and one issue alone, and that was the Supreme Court. And progressives just didn't make the connection or didn't think it was material.
And you both have written extensively about this. Before we dive into that, let's just talk about why this is so important. John Malcolm, the vice president of the Heritage Foundation's Institute for Constitutional Government, and of course they're thrilled with these picks, told Business Insider that who the judges are in these lower courts have a significant impact on the direction of law. He said, the federal courts of appeals hear 50,000 cases a year. The Supreme Court only hears about 75 cases a year. So 75 cases in the Supreme Court and about 50,000 when you're talking about the federal courts. David, Diane, I'm guessing a lot of people don't know this.
Yeah, probably not. And they don't know about this multi-decade effort on the part of the conservative movement to really focus on the federal courts. You know, I think Democrats and liberals focus on the legislative arena to a large degree to set social policy, domestic policy, and the conservatives really look at the entire system and recognize that the you know, if you have a stranglehold on the federal judiciary, you can block a good deal of what is done in the legislative arena. And it's really a more holistic view of the government and where you know, the ability and the maneuvering that you can do to help control it. And so they are extremely focused. They are very vigorous. They are capitalizing at this point on something Democrats actually initiated, which is allowing judges to be confirmed by majority vote. Mm-hmm. So they do not require the assistance of any Democrats in order to confirm these judges. And they're actually going a bit further because there's this real battle happening right now. It hasn't fully been worked out yet, but the ability for individual senators to block judges that come from their states, that will be representing their states in the federal judiciary. It's called the blue slip rule, and it's a bit arcane. Basically, senators can withhold a blue slip if they do not want a particular judge to advance through the Judiciary Committee. Under Democrats, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy, honored the blue slip rule, and many Republicans withheld the ability for Obama's judges to go forward. So that created a large amount of vacancies, which is what Trump's capitalizing on. Democrats are, you know, at least one, Al Franken, has tried to use the blue slip rule. However, Mitch McConnell has intimated that they would not honor this tradition, this norm in the U.S. Senate, and therefore, you know, you have this sort of disproportionate warfare being conducted over the courts where Republicans just don't see any obstacles in their path, and Democrats kind of honor the Senate traditions and allow Republicans to obstruct. So that's really part of the story as well.
Yeah, I appreciated that you wrote about the blue slip rule in your recent piece. Again, this is not something that gets discussed much. You report that if Republicans change the rule, it would be all too typical. When Republicans hold the Senate and want a president to get judges through, they relax the blue slip rules. When the president is a Democrat, they tighten them. Dahlia, can you tell us a little bit more about the blue slip rule and why this is so important right now?
Well, I think what David identified as the problem is it's so arcane, Rose. It kind of goes to this deeply entrenched Senate tradition that home state senators should have some say in who gets tapped to sit on the federal courts in their states. And it's a little bit a question of states' rights, you know, a feeling that we should empower senators to have something of a veto over the president's judicial picks. But also, I think for years, the tradition, it's a 100-year-old tradition, I think it's been honored largely because it has forced presidents to confer with home state senators. And even if that meant, you know, I hate your pick, I hate you, we're not putting anyone up, which is kind of what we saw in, you know, the Fifth Circuit, some of the Texas senators who made it so impossible for Obama to put up any judges in the Fifth Circuit, that we have a huge, huge backlog of judicial vacancies there. But at least there were conversations. And I think one of the things that's interesting about Republicans now saying we're going to do away with the blue slip altogether is that some of the states actually responded to the blue slip problem, whether, you know, the kind of back and forth of president pick someone, opposing party senators refuse to give a blue slip, is some of the states like Oregon and Washington State and several others actually crafted these interesting bipartisan commissions. And the commissions would work together across party lines, pick people who were more or less centrists, acceptable to both sides. Right. And one of the reasons that Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden in Oregon are saying they're just going to refuse to even hear the confirmation hearing of Ryan Bounds, he's one of Trump's picks to be a judge in Oregon, is because Trump just bypassed the commission. He said, I don't care that you have worked together across party lines. I'm not even conferring with the commission. I'm not even conferring with the home state senators. And I think really, I guess, the nut of the reason that we have honored the blue slip tradition on both sides going back 100 years is because it did force these kind of conversations and compromises that even if you hate the president as a home state senator, you have some back and forth, some ability to bargain. And now that's just gone. And so Wyden and Merkley are saying, fine, if you are bypassing our commission, you're not meeting with us, you're just picking your people, no blue slip. And as David says, the response that Mitch McConnell has given in the last few weeks is, that's just fine. We'll do away with the blue slip, too.
Can you also talk about the significance of the 50 votes needed for passage, meaning Republicans can confirm judges at all levels without any Democratic support?
Right. I mean, we had a filibuster rule, and we had a rule that said that you needed a supermajority to confirm federal judges. As David noted, it was the Democrats, when they controlled the Senate, that got rid of that rule for lower court judges. They did it, they said at the time, because they were just every single Obama nominee that was being tapped was being blocked. And finally, they said, that's fine. We're doing away with the filibuster rule only for lower court judges, for federal district court and appellate court judges. The rule will stay in place. They all agreed, and there was a bipartisan agreement among leaders of the Senate. We would preserve it in the case of Supreme Court nominees, that it was important to be able to confirm a Supreme Court nominee with more than 51 votes. And as we saw when Neil Gorsuch was blocked, when Democrats threatened to filibuster him, the Republican leadership in the Senate said, good, now we're done with that rule, too. And they overcame the filibuster. So now we have exactly the situation that we were most afraid of in the Senate, which is that you can ram through judicial nominees with 51 votes. And it goes back a little to your initial question, Rose, about the nature of the kinds of folks who are being put up, because we have people who literally were bloggers, people with no judicial history, almost no legal history, who write unspeakable things on blogs and get confirmed anyway because no downside.
We talked about the rules. Let's talk about the politics. David, in your latest piece about this, you write that if you want to know about the real difference between Democrats and Republicans on the judiciary, this is one of the key points. Republicans see appointing rigidly conservative judges as a central part of their policy strategy, whereas Barack Obama, like Bill Clinton before him, used judicial nominations as an opportunity for bipartisan comedy. Can you talk about that, David?
Yeah. I mean, obviously the rules were different back then, at least for part of the Obama era and for all of the Clinton era. And those rules were changed to allow 50 votes to get a lower court judge on board, Obama's judicial nominations, at least some observers say, tended away from that centrism a little bit. However, I think the broader point still stands. What Trump is going for, whether it's right wing bloggers or people that have a very rigid philosophy in terms of conservative judicial philosophy, that including their youth, because I mean most of the Trump judges are in their 40s in that age. Because these are lifetime appointments, so they stay on as long as really they want to. That's been the strategy from the right going, before Trump. And on the left, we haven't really seen that same kind of real aggressiveness. And this really does go back to these outside structures. The Federalist Society really is a almost cradle to the grave support network for right leaning judges, getting them these appointments, making sure they see the right people and know the right people, and getting them on the federal bench for lifetime appointments. That structure just doesn't exist on the left. There is this thing called the American Constitutional Society that was attempted to be almost a mirror of the Federalist Society, but it really does not have the same kind of reach. And as I've said, Democrats, it seems like trend toward the legislative arena as the way to change policy and kind of put the judicial arena somewhat in the background. I think even Obama said that we don't want, activists judges that make policy. So that's just sort of a philosophical difference between the parties.
What explains that, Dahlia? Ronald Klain, who worked with the American Constitution Society, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about this and said Democrats in the White House and on Capitol Hill have been reluctant to form a similar alliance with the American Constitution Society to identify potential judicial nominees. When the Dems regain control over the nomination or confirmation process, he wrote, they need to be enthusiastic about working with the ACS as other progressive groups, as Republicans have been about their alliance with the Federalist Society. Dahlia, what do you think explains that?
Some of it really is the temperamental question that David just described. I mean, Barack Obama was so slow to even put up judges at all. He figured, I've got other big ambitious things to do. I want to get healthcare reform done. I want to do other things. And Obama famously said, I'm never going to put up a Brennan. I'm never going to put up a Thurgood Marshall. Elections matter. Policies change in the legislative branch, not in the court. So I think there is this temperamental sense that packing the court with left-wing judges is not an appropriate response to what Bush had done before him, which is packing the court with right-wing judges. So I think there is a slowness, a tendency to focus on other issues. By the time the Obama administration really started ramping up and thinking seriously about the judicial branch, it was way late. I mean, think about the fact that Donald Trump has already got 6 judges confirmed. That breaks every record because it's just that question of focus. But I think there's another answer, and I think it's a little meta, but bear with me. I think that generally liberals have had a very hard time messaging and articulating their vision for what a jurist should do. So that if you know, ask yourself, what do Republicans say on the stump about judges? We know the formula, right? They hate activist judges who substitute their own, you know, moral values for the strictly construed words of the Constitution, right? It rolls off the tongue. Everybody knows it. The analog on the left has been very murky. And I think that part of the problem is because we don't kind of know how to talk about what we want in a judge, we do tend to do a little bit of this, like, oh, he's got a good heart, he's a nice person, he has empathy, you know, she really is a minority and that's what matters. Those are not judicial philosophies. They're not ideas. And so I think that then when you get to these salient moments in confirmation hearings where the country is ready to hear what is it that a progressive judge thinks and does and values, there's no answer to that. And so I think partly the reason that the White House and ACS don't have a kind of lockstep coordination that you're describing as between, you know, the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society and the Trump White House is because I think it's awfully unclear, even to people who are right there in the trenches, how they can talk about and think about what a progressive judge does.
What would you add, David?
I think that's right. I just think it's a different conception of politics and public policy. It's almost that it would be unfair, that it would be overstepping the boundaries to have a judge that asserts various ideas about the law. I do think that there's a confusion there. I think that Democrats and the Democratic Party has really been sort of a coalition of interests, a coalition of sort of siloed different interests, whether it's environmental policy or healthcare policy or poverty policy or whatever. And for some reason, judicial policy has not really been part of that siloed process. Maybe because it's so separate, there's not this sort of umbrella philosophy that is put in to really talk about what a liberal judge, what the strategy or the way in which those can get onto the bench and what they're supposed to support. I mean, that language does not exist, and I think Dahlia is making a very important point.
Dahlia, I want to make sure I have my facts right. Donald Trump has nominated 57 judges so far to sit on federal courts. Do we know how many have been confirmed?
We've had 6 confirmed. He nominated another on September 17th. He nominated, he added 16 to that list, which brings it up to the number you put forward. But I also would say hold that up against the vacancies, the gaping vacancies in the rest of government. I mean, it is an astounding reflection of the value of these judicial seats if you consider that, you know, there are whole departments that are practically shuttered because he's failed to nominate people. And yet on the courts, so far ahead of where anyone else was. So it's I think the statistic is extraordinary, but it's particularly telling in light of the fact that staffing up the rest of the government doesn't seem to be a priority at all.
Yeah, just for context, President Obama at this point in his presidency, I think it's about 15 nominations.
Wow.
For judges.
15
so
versus 57.
A significant difference.
And you both have reported that a lot of these nominees are very young, some of them in their 40s, whereas a lot of the Democratic nominees are in their mid to late 50s. Dahlia, talk about the significance of this.
Well, again, I mean, these are lifetime appointments. And remember, when the framers wrote the Constitution and were handing out lifetime Article III appointments, that was because you lived to be 50, not 90. So, you know, think about the current Supreme Court. If you really, really want to be having a bad day, you know, think about the fact that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 84, Anthony Kennedy is 81, Stephen Breyer is 59. I mean, this is an extraordinary lifelong tenure position that, you know, with all due respect to very, very elderly people, Trump may have three judicial appointments. And the three justices I just named of the Supreme Court were all in the majority on, you know, think of every single case that has been a huge civil rights, civil liberties win, whether it's whole women's health and reproductive freedom, whether it's upholding affirmative action in higher education, whether it's Obergefell, the marriage equality case. I mean, those are – that trifecta was key to those holdings. And so I think that really, you know, folks who went to the ballot box and didn't rank the fact that we had an 84, 81, and 79-year-old Supreme Court justice as – if not the issue, certainly a top three issue, I think tells you a lot about how Democrats have just completely somehow failed to message how important the court is.
And just one more thing on that is that at the time that Trump entered office, there were simply more vacancies available than there were at the time Obama entered office, and that has to do with the obstruction that was being done by Republicans in the final 2 years of the Obama presidency, putting sort of a virtual freeze on confirmations in those last 2 years, which wasn't necessarily the case in the last few years of the Bush presidency, even though Democrats held the Senate at that point. It's something like I wrote in my report that at the beginning of June 2009, at the sort of six-month point of the Obama presidency, there were 72 judicial vacancies. And at that same point in 2017, there were 132. So that's almost 2-1. And so there's simply more capacity, more room to run for Trump to do these confirmations and to fill these spots because there are simply more spots vacant.
David Dalian.
And if I could add one.
Sure, go ahead, Dalia.
If I could add one other thing, I think the most important word in this conversation is norms. And when, you know, the Senate Republicans started tweeting within an hour of Antonin Scalia's death, there would be no hearing for anybody at all for the rest of the Obama presidency. I mean, that wasn't a rule. That's not a law. Mm. It's just a norm. And so as these norms collapse, I think Democrats tend to say, well, isn't there a lawsuit? Why can't we file a lawsuit? Who can we impeach over this? But these are not laws. These are norms. And if Republicans in the Senate simply choose to collapse those norms and say no harm, no foul, the recourse is not there.
Dalia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. David Dayan writes for The Nation, The Intercept, and The New Republic. Today, we are talking about how Donald Trump will transform the federal bench for generations to come. This is a really important fact. The Supreme Court hears about 75 cases a year, very important cases. But the federal courts of appeals hear 50,000 cases a year, also very important cases. Coming up after the break, we'll talk more specifically about some of these extreme judges that Donald Trump has nominated. And then we'll also talk about Dahlia's recent piece about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and the effect that he's having on these judges. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You can go to the telephone. You can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may go to the yourcallradio.org website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
The This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about a new 10-foot-tall Women's Column of Strength Memorial that'll be unveiled in San Francisco's Chinatown on Friday. San Francisco is about to become the first major U.S. city to honor the 200,000 women and girls from 13 Asia-Pacific countries who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military during World War II, often referred to as the Comfort Women. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow. And then Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how Donald Trump's judicial nominees will transform the federal bench for generations to come. He is nominating very conservative judges to the bench. 57 nominees so far, and 6 have been confirmed. The Senate only requires 50 votes for passage, meaning Republicans can confirm these judges without any Democratic support. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What do you think this says about the future of the Republican Party and the Democrats, how they deal with this issue? And we're going to talk more about some of these specific judges, because some of the things that they've said about transgender children, about women, about abortion, about slavery, I mean, this should be getting so much more attention. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by David Dayan. He writes for The Nation, The Intercept, and The New Republic. He's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, and Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. She also hosts the podcast Amicus. And we've got a number of callers on the line. Let's go to Sanchez in Long Beach. Hi, Sanchez. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Good morning, Rose, and good morning to your guests. David was in your previous segment discussing when the Democratic Party Congress can confirm judges for the bench, that's future judges. The question would be, how confident are they of this plan with the midterms elections traditionally going more to conservative and older voters, where the presidential, the bigger games and the younger voters are more for the presidential elections, which tend to go more towards the Democrats? And with the damaged brand of the Democratic Party, how confident are we of ever seeing a Democratic Party Congress again that would pass these judge seats?
Thank you, Sanchez. David, what are your thoughts?
Well, the map in 2018 for the Senate is not favorable at all to Democrats. Democrats, I think, are defending 25 seats relative to 8 seats for Republicans, most of those in very deep red states. So it's actually kind of unlikely that Democrats take the Senate. It's far more likely that they take the House. And at that point, if that is what holds, Democrats control the House and Republicans by a bare margin control the Senate, really the 2019 and 2020 are going to be almost exclusively about confirming judges to these vacancies, because that will be the main thing that a Congress can bring to President Trump. And this, you know, to make another point, this is kind of why I think that, you know, there's always this question of when are Republicans going to throw over President Trump? And the answer is never. And one of the reasons why is that they're perfectly content to have him send over these judges and make, you know, decisions that will have ramifications 20, 30, 40 years down the road. There's no reason to disrupt that process. This is the only area where that's actually working at this point. Certainly the legislative arena hasn't had, you know, the kind of long-lasting change that Republicans wanted. But in the judicial arena, that opportunity exists, and it's extremely possible. And so, you know, if Democrats do not capture the Senate in 2018... we're going to see another 2 years of this, most likely.
Dahlia, what do you think?
No, I think critically important to this conversation is that folks who voted with their eye only on the Supreme Court got exactly what they wanted, and they will endure a whole lot of crazy because they're playing a long game, and because, you know, some of these nominees, I'm just looking at Damian Schiff, a nominee for the Court of Federal Claims. I mean, 37 years old. Some of these folks are really closer to my children's age than mine, and they're going to be on the bench for decades and decades and decades, and that is a long game. You can endure almost anything Donald Trump does for 4 years, knowing that on issues of reproductive rights, on issues of Second Amendment freedoms, the kinds of things that matter more than even, I would say, you know, tax breaks and doing away with the Affordable Care Act. On these issues, Trump-based voters who care about the court are getting precisely what they wanted.
Since you brought up Damian Schiff, you wrote about him in a recent piece, Dahlia, and I want to make sure that we let listeners know who some of these, a lot of men, I'm sure there are some women, but are they overwhelmingly male?
They're overwhelmingly male. They're overwhelmingly white. Just as a coda to the judicial part of this, Trump has put forward names for U.S. attorneys in the various states, and I think all but one are white and overwhelmingly male. So, in addition to packing the courts, and this is something for which Obama doesn't get credit, but really should. Obama was scrupulous, as was Bill Clinton before him, in trying to make the courts look like America, and scrupulous in putting up, very, very diverse, often moderate, and often not radical progressive thinkers, but at least a diverse-looking bench, putting up openly gay judges, putting up a whole bunch of women and minorities. And Trump is really veering back to the sort of male federal bench, white male U.S. attorneys. It's really deeply destabilizing for people who are law students, for instance, at this moment, to see the courts veering back to what the courts looked like when their grandfathers were young.
You report 37-year-old Damian Schiff is a nominee for the U.S. Court of Federal Claims, which oversees environmental and agency suits. He is an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He's also a blogger. You write that in 2009, he railed against the anti-bullying program in a California school district. He said, quote, "I have not seen the proposed lesson, but it seems to teach not only that bullying of homosexuals is wrong, but also that the homosexual lifestyle is good, and that homosexual families are the moral equivalent of traditional heterosexual families." And then he added, "Perhaps someone will respond. Would you have objected to an anti-racism curriculum being taught in 1950s Arkansas? I guess my answer there would be a qualified yes, that I would have objected, not that I would approve of racism, but that as a prudential matter, the best way to get people to drop their racist views would not be to force the teaching of their children." What else can you tell us about this guy, Damian Schiff, 37 years old?
Well, one point of clarification, and this is important, is we've been talking about lifetime appointments. As you mentioned, Schiff is up for the Court of Federal Claims. That's not a lifetime appointment. But yes, 37, extraordinarily young, and all the other folks that Trump is putting up are in their 40s and 50s. So I think we are looking at extraordinarily youthful nominees. The other thing that Schiff wrote when he was at the Pacific Legal Foundation was a blog post calling Justice Anthony Kennedy, his potentially future colleague at the Supreme Court, a judicial prostitute. That's his language. Selling his vote, as it were, to four other justices in exchange for the high that comes from aggrandizement of power and influence and the blandishments of the fawning media and legal academy. I mean, the kinds of people who write that Anthony Kennedy is a prostitute were not the kinds of people who would get hearings typically. One of the interesting things at Schiff's confirmation hearing was that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse was so horrified by the kind of caliber of people who were coming before him that he just stopped asking questions. He just said, I can't even participate in this because it's so extraordinary. And the fact that nobody is reckoning with how extraordinary these people are makes it almost impossible for me to do my job here. And it's interesting because I think some of the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee, which really holds itself out as a very kind of gravitas, thoughtful, high-status committee full of mostly lawyers who think deeply about the courts, some of the Republicans on the committee said, you know, this is not appropriate. This is not okay. But you know what? They all voted for them anyway.
Wow. You also read about 52-year-old John Bush, a Sixth Circuit nominee from Kentucky. And he also has blogging commentary saying that abortion and slavery are the two greatest tragedies in our country. His blog posts have cited conspiracy theories, including references to the claim that Obama was not born in the U.S. And then he described the horrific beating of Rodney King, and we just did a show about this, as a, quote, police encounter.
And he's been confirmed.
Yeah. And he's been confirmed.
And he's also been confirmed. And the folks who, again, evinced horror, even on the Republican side of the aisle, voted for him. One of the things he did, and this is really important, at his confirmation hearings, Bush just simply said, you know, I wrote those when I was a political person, but I'm going to put my robe on and all of those things will be cleansed away. And I will approach every case with, you know, a blank and open mind and a big heart. And I think part of, you know, when we talked earlier about how we don't talk enough on the left about judicial philosophy is to allow people to make kind of fatuous claims about everything I was politically, everything I wrote and stood for is now gone. We're going to reboot my brain and I'm going to be an open-minded judge is just so profoundly disingenuous. A version of that was Chief Justice John Roberts' balls and strikes claim, you know, that there, it doesn't matter what my personal opinion is because I have no ideology. All that matters is, quote, applying neutrally the law. And that kind of being able to constantly go back to that well and say, everything I did before, everything I said and wrote is immaterial because I will approach this like a supercomputer is part of the just really impoverished discourse we have around the issue of what judges do.
Wow. Before we get to calls, David, anything to add on this?
Well, I mean, Talia really just says it all right there. One thing I would add is, you know, we've talked about the disproportionality of how conservatives look at this issue versus liberals. And you see that with this blue slip issue. I just wanted to bring up one thing. You know, you're having a show where you're saying most liberals don't even know what the blue slip issue is. It's very arcane. It's very odd. And under the radar, the Judicial Crisis Network, which is one of these organizations on the right that really focuses on judges, has placed ads in Minnesota targeting Al Franken for not returning his blue slip on a justice named David Strauss. Who is being put forward for the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. So they don't have a problem with this arcane issue. They will even put it in ads and target to their base that they're fighting on this particular, you know, Senate tradition, this administrative kind of issue. I don't think you would ever see anything like that comparable on the left. They would, you know, people would talk themselves out of it. People don't care about process. People don't understand this stuff. So that's the difference, too, is that this is so important to the right that they're willing to spare no expense and they don't worry about whether voters or constituents will be confused by the issues.
David Dayan's latest piece in the New Republic is called Trump's Judicial Picks Are Keeping Republicans Happy and Quiet. He writes for the New Republic, The Nation, and The Intercept. And Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. She hosts the podcast Amicists. And you can see her reporting at yourcallradio.org. One of her recent pieces is Polemicists in Robes. Let's go next to Roger in Fremont. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I had a question, which is, given the president can be impeached, I believe judges could also be impeached by Congress if, in fact, the Democrats were to get enough seats in the people in the Senate. Is that a possibility? I seem to recall that some judges in the past have been removed. And I'll take my answer on the air.
Thanks. Dahlia?
I think the standard for what a judge has to do to be impeachable is so high. I mean, it's partly, you know, the same high standard that applies to Trump. And you obviously can't impeach Trump judges just because, you know, if Trump were impeached, they would have to themselves show misconduct to an extraordinarily high level. And, you know, writing nasty blog posts or striking down Roe v. Wade is not impeachable. There have certainly been historically efforts to impeach, for instance, Byron White. I think, I think it's not out of the range of possibilities that folks could try to impeach Trump judges. But as I said, the standard can't be, that they're just people who are resolutely undoing the Warren Revolution. That's not an impeachable offense.
All right. Thank you, Roger. Let's go next to Alec in Oakland. Hi, Alec. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I just have a comment. Everything that the people have said, you know, the people on your show, just shows how totally incompetent the Democrats have been. I mean, you had a show about that book, Rat Nest, where they blew that. The Democrats have just failed us for the last 50 years. That's my comment.
Well, yeah, thank you. Alec was referring to a book, Rat Effed, by David Daley, and it's about gerrymandering. And in the book, a number of Southern Dems approached Nancy Pelosi and said, we need to do something about gerrymandering, and she just didn't take them seriously.
Yeah, I often get mistaken for David Daley.
I'm sure.
It's hard to see this particular issue. I won't speak to the gerrymandering issue, but it's hard to see this particular issue as anything but a failure on the part of the Democratic Party to think very seriously about the courts and the importance in people's lives of making these lifetime appointments and doing what needs to be done to make sure that they get filled. It's fixable if you have the political will and the understanding of the vital nature of this. But so far, there hasn't been much of a ramp up.
You also report, David, that like other Democratic presidents since Carter, Obama set a tougher bar for himself. He interpreted the Senate confirmation rules to mean that he had to achieve widespread support for all of his nominees.
Yeah, and that was even true to an extent after they changed the threshold from 60 votes to 50 votes. And it speaks to Obama's general temperament. And maybe that is rubbed off on the entire Democratic Party as well. Maybe it's just a reflection of that. So, I think what needs to happen is that a strong assessment of the kinds of things that Dahlia is saying, the importance of the courts in people's lives, and that this has to be a priority, and it has to be a priority every day, in addition to just in... And it really has to be a priority on Election Day, which it really isn't to most, a large portion of the Democratic base.
Dahlia, you have a cover story with your colleague Mark Joseph Stern about Clarence Thomas called The Clarence Thomas Takeover. And you report that Clarence Thomas is more than just the Trump administration's philosophical hero. His once fringy ideas are suddenly flourishing. They want less government, a more authoritarian executive, more God, fewer racial entitlements, and more guns. And you report that everywhere you turn in Trump land, you find a slew of Clarence Thomas's former clerks in high places. What kind of mark does Clarence Thomas have on these nominations?
I think it's such a fascinating development that we noticed almost immediately. If you think about how there is a real fissure at the U.S. Supreme Court on the conservative block of the Supreme Court, largely John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy have stood kind of at the middle. I mean, they're certainly extremely conservative and on many, many issues that liberals care about. They have voted conservative, but there is such a profound difference between where John Roberts is and where Clarence Thomas is. And Clarence Thomas really, truly has been throughout his tenure at the Supreme Court very much on the fringe, far to the right in many instances of Antonin Scalia, but really, I think, tending to dissent alone time after time after time with theories about, strong presidential power that's virtually unchecked, doing away with the entire federal safety net, wildly opposing any kind of gun control. I can go on. Mm. And if all that sounds familiar, it's because these are fringe ideas that the center right never accepted. And certainly Chief Justice John Roberts hasn't accepted, but Trump does. And so what you're really seeing is a marriage of the minds now between Trump, who I don't think any love is lost between Chief Justice John Roberts and Donald Trump. But the centrists don't matter because suddenly the real fringe of the Supreme Court, as you said, is staffing up Washington.
You also report that at the precise moment in which the more than 120 vacancies on the courts may be the only reason for conservatives to hold their noses and stand by Trump, that's exactly what David Diane wrote, it's Clarence Thomas who stands as a living embodiment of wars already won and triumphs yet to come. In our remaining moments, Dahlia, what can citizens do about this?
It's a great question, and I think that the short answer is next time there's a Merrick Garland blockade, you have to care. You have to call your senator. You have to just not hope this just pans out. I think that one of the reasons that opposition to Neil Gorsuch finally grew in the last days of his hearings and Democrats who were on the fence decided to filibuster was because folks were finally engaged on the left. They were calling. They were angry. But that was way too late. So I think really, as David keeps saying, thinking about this, not winning the last battle, which we lost, but thinking in a forward-thinking way about how can I make the composition of the judicial branch a priority for me and my senator? I think that kind of work has to happen now.
David, what would you add? About 30 seconds.
Yeah, I would agree. This is too important to leave to the way that Democrats have traditionally approached the issue. And I do think there was a sea change there with Gorsuch. Remember, in the beginning, they said that they were going to, not filibuster because maybe they might get someone worse or they were saving the filibuster for a later fight or something like that. And that changed. Mm. And so, hopefully we'll see how that affects the future.
It's amazing to think that Obama appointed or nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court because he's a moderate, thinking that he would get Republicans to confirm him. And they blocked it. David Diane writes for The Nation, The Intercept, and The New Republic. You can see his latest piece, Trump's Judicial Picks Are Keeping Republicans Happy and Quiet, at yourcallradio.org. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. She also hosts the podcast Amicus. You could read one of her latest pieces, Polemicists in Robes, also at yourcallradio.org. David and Dahlia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, San Francisco is about to become the first major U.S. city to honor the 200,000 women and girls from 13 Asia-Pacific countries who were forced into sexual slavery by the Japanese military during World War II. The 10-foot-tall Women's Column of Strength Memorial will be unveiled on Friday in San Francisco's Chinatown. Tomorrow, we will talk about this history, and you can find more information about it online. You can actually take a look at what this looks like. It's beautiful. You can find it on the Chronicle's website. Your Call is produced here at KALW. If you'd like to listen to past shows, head over to yourcallradio.org. You can also sign up for our podcast there. You can also sign up at iTunes. Thanks to Ellie Budner for producing today's show. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.